be profitable this year. You can see there the first yellow column on the right-hand side shows that net profit forecast for this year is 11.7 billion. But more importantly, I just want to show what has happened structurally to the airline industry. In the bit that I've highlighted there is fuel. And if you look at 2004, the fuel bill, collective fuel bill for the airline industry was $65 billion. It represented 17% of the industry's cost base. The average price of a barrel of oil was $38.30. And the industry lost $5.6 billion. So oil, $38 a barrel. Now you move forward to 2012, last year. The oil price had increased to $111.80. The fuel bill had gone up to $210 billion. As a percentage of our cost, fuel now represented 32% of the industry's cost base. But look at the profitability. We've gone from losing over 5 billion, almost 6 billion in 2004, to 7 billion of profit in 2012. So this is an industry that has shown incredible adaptability. We've been able to adapt to this really significant change in the oil price. But more importantly, structurally, what we've had is an industry that has moved from being one that has had a very high fixed cost to one that has higher variable costs. And this plays a really important part in why the industry is doing better today. Because if you have variable costs, it's easier to reduce capacity. And if you look at Michael O'Leary's airline Ryanair, fuel represents almost 50% of his total costs. His variable costs within the airline are over 80% of his total cost base. So Ryanair can take the decision to stop flying during the weak demand periods. And last year, they had 80 of their 290 aircraft, just rounded, sitting on the ground in airports that you've never heard of around Europe. This year, he's going to do something similar, because he can avoid a lot of his costs by just taking the capacity out. And clearly, if, as an industry, you can match capacity to demand in a better way, you're more likely to be in profit than we have in the past. This is a really significant structural change in the airline industry, and it's one where, in a strange way, higher oil prices have actually benefited the industry, because it has given us a new sense of discipline in relation to capacity management. Now, this is my final chart, because I like to talk about the Gulf carriers. And unlike some of my competitors around Europe, I'm not a critic of the Gulf carriers. In fact, I'm really positive about what they have done. I'm a great admirer of how the Gulf carriers have developed in recent years. This shows you a chart of the destinations served by the Gulf carriers in 2013. In 1998, they served 48 destinations. 15 of those were in Europe. You can see there in Europe now they have 45 destinations. And clearly this is changing every day of the week. But what's really good about the carriers based in the Middle East, and principally the three big carriers, Emirates, Qatar, and Etihad, is that they have demonstrated the true economic contribution that aviation can make. And probably no better example of that than Emirates in Dubai. In 2001, Dubai ranked number 99 in the world in terms of international passengers. 99 in the world. Heathrow was number one. Last year, Heathrow continued to be number one. It was the busiest international airport. Not the busiest airport, but the busiest international airport in the world. But Dubai had moved from 99 in the world to number two. So in the space of just over 10 years, they had gone from number 99 to number two. And this year, they will probably run Heathrow very close to being number one. Certainly, I think by next year, they will have overtaken Heathrow as the busiest international airport in the world. And what that demonstrates is how the government in the United Arab Emirates and the government in Qatar has appreciated the economic value of having a global network. And it's estimated that in 2020, Dubai Airport and the Emirates, but the activity around the airport, will represent 22% of all employment in Dubai. and contribute 32% of the GDP of Taiwan. So what they have there is what I would like to see in the rest of the world. They have governments who appreciate the contribution that they make. They have good infrastructure, new infrastructure, sufficient and expanding infrastructure. They've got a positive attitude towards taxation. And they are encouraging their airlines to grow so that their economies can grow off the back of the airline growth. And I'm delighted that this time next week I will be in Doha to celebrate Qatar Airways joining the One World Alliance. I think that's another major step forward in recognizing the contribution that the carriers in the Middle East are making to the global aviation economy. But this is truly an example of what aviation can do. It's part of what is behind the figures that Eric showed you in the beginning, and it clearly is something that we're all going to watch in the years ahead. Thank you very much.
Take a seat, and we've got a few minutes just to pick over some of the points you've raised there, and perhaps I'm going to come up with some new ones. I'm going to start with a very basic question, and that is simply this. I think many people in this room whose businesses depend on retail inside airports worry that airlines really don't give don't overly concern themselves with what happens inside the airport beyond getting the passenger from curbside as efficiently and quickly as possible into the plane. But they don't like many of the attitudes that airlines bring to the relationship with the airport. Is that fair?
No, I think it's a general statement that you really have to dig into that. I think there are some airlines that take that view, and I think there are others who recognize the very important contribution that retail stores make at airports. So Heathrow, for example, we have a regulated charge environment at Heathrow, a single till, where the contribution that the retail stores at Heathrow makes offsets the total cost of operating Heathrow. So airlines benefit to a significant degree from the contribution of the retail activities at the airport base, because it keeps our landing charges and our passenger charges down. I think there are other airports around the world where the airline sees that they make the major contribution and that the retail stores should be rewarding them, or the airport should be rewarding them for bringing all of these customers. So I think it does very much depend on the nature of the airport and the structure of the airport and the contribution and the size of the retail contribution at the airports. I thought the presentation by Eric about the one bag rule, which was inevitable, to be honest with you.
Where do you stand on the one bag rule? Because Eric made a very strong point about how it's doing real damage to many of the businesses represented here today. BA doesn't currently operate the one bag rule, but you're in a very competitive environment, and I happen to know that you are always looking for ways to improve your business, make it more efficient and more cost effective. And are you going to go down that route?
No, we looked at it, and very quickly realized that if we were to introduce that, it would be damaging to retail sales at Heathrow, likely to be damaging to retail sales, which would have a negative effect on the retail contribution to the Heathrow revenue base, and therefore have
But why should you care about that?
Because as long as you have a single till economic regulation, it's very relevant to us to have retail contributing to the profitability of the airport, because it does keep our charges down. If you move to a dual till, which some people want, then you would see a very different attitude from airlines. I think a dual till where all the retail revenue contributions kept separate from the airline contribution, I think you will see a backlash from airlines that would seek to restrict the benefit that the retail and the airport gets from passengers. So it's always a single till economic regulatory environment, and it's in our interest to see retail to work at the airports. And that's our attitude. So we're not going to try and limit what our customers can bring on board. We're not going to try and discourage them selling, even though we're trying to sell the loads of border aircraft as well.
If you could start from scratch and define your model relationship between an airline and airport, what would it look like?
It's very simple. I think historically airports were airport authorities. So when I first met Colin Matthews, CEO of sometimes call us BAA, and you sometimes call us the BAA. And I said, well, if you notice, when I refer to you as the BAA, I'm not being very kind to you. And he said, well, can you stop using the lineage and just call us BAA? And I said, well, when you stop acting like an authority and start treating us like a customer, then I'll start calling you by your real title. And that's a problem. I think it's still in the DNA of many airports that they are an airport authority and that they tell you what to do. And that relationship has not been one of customer and supplier, which it should be. Now, many airports have adapted, and there are some very, very good airports around the world. I'm going to Baltimore the weekend after next, speaking at an event there. Baltimore is probably one of the most positive airports you could operate with, because they genuinely value us as a customer. They go out of the way to try and understand what it is we need and want to make our operations better in the interest of our customers. So it does depend. And simply what I would say is, if you wanted a positive relationship, I think airports have got to look at airlines as customers and not as, you know, this nuisance that tries to force them to do things.
But I suspect a lot of people in the room look at, particularly the marketplace in Europe, and look at the seemingly inexorable growth of low-cost airlines and feel that low-cost airlines are really doing them no favours in terms of the businesses they're trying to operate. I noticed, you know, you are incredibly positive about Vueling, which is your low-cost Spanish business. You've got big growth plans for it, and it even appeared on Eric's list of airport killers. I'm sure you noticed that.
It's pretty small.
I think they had 11 to their name, 11 kills to their name. But the point is, if that is the way in which Europe continues to go, it is pretty bad news, probably, for a lot of people in this room.
No, I don't think so. I think you should look at the positive. You should look at the right-hand side of that chart, which were the new routes. I think what you've got to recognize is that the difference between airlines today and airlines 10 years ago, now, they're much more flexible. They can make decisions to try and start a new destination, and where it doesn't work, they can terminate it. And airlines are not there just to fly from one airport to another. We're there to make money. Let's be clear about this. You know, I'm in business to make money. I'm in business to be profitable. I'm in business to pay a dividend to my shareholders. I have not been doing that, and I need to do that.
And is low cost for you going to be a bigger and bigger part of your way of making money?
It's part of it. I think people shouldn't associate low cost with profitability. I think there are some very profitable low-cost airlines, and there are some very unprofitable low-cost airlines. I think people in the past, in the recent history, have made the mistake of associating the low-cost label with automatic profitability. There are some low-cost airlines, or labeled low-cost airlines, who have never made a penny and never will make a penny. So you can have profitable full-service network carriers, you can have unprofitable. So it's all about profitability, to be honest with you. Business model needs to be the business model that is appropriate to that segment of the market. And we think Vueling has a very good business model. It's done something that most airlines have failed to do, is able to grow at a very fast pace and grow its profitability at the same time.
All right, we don't have a huge amount of time, but maybe some quick fire questions. One on security in airports. Obviously, airlines involved in all negotiations about the future of security arrangements and procedures. Does the current status quo work for you, and where do you see it going in the next 5 years?
No, it doesn't work. And the problem we have is that we're getting this layered approach to security. So we have everything that went before, and then something new happens, and you get a new security procedure layered on top of it. What we need is a fundamental review. Let's start again, and let's stop doing some of the things that are not necessary. A lot of you have got umbrellas. I got an umbrella when we checked into the hotel last night. If you've ever flown out of Dublin Airport, probably the only airport in the world where one of the things they used to ask you, you know, laptop, shoes, blah, 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 have you got an umbrella? And if you had an umbrella, you had to take the umbrella out of the case because they had failed in a security order where somebody had managed to sneak something through an umbrella. So the solution to that was, well, let's add umbrellas to the list of things you've got to take out quickly. That's a nonsense. You know, the technology that is available today is so much better than what was available even 5 years ago. You know, there's no reason why you need to take laptops out of your bag. In most airports, the x-ray machines are well able to see through it, but the regulations say you do, and it's because you have regulators who are afraid to stand up and say they don't need to do this anymore.
Right. In-flight retail, again, a lot of people are really interested in whether the airlines, and your airline in particular, actually remain prohibitive doing flight retail, or whether, frankly, you know, you could live without it, you quite like to live without it?
Not absolutely committed to it. It makes sense to us. It's a profitable part of our business, and it's one that we intend to retain going forward.
But what airlines don't do it for?
No, but you know, a lot of airlines, you need to look at the customer segmentation. You know, particularly on British Airways, we've got a good customer base where they actually want to buy things and board the aircraft. They like it, and it's profitable for us. And anything that's profitable is something that we're going to take.
Yeah, I believe that. But final point, I'm going to study real quick. A lot of people in the room will also want to know whether you, and maybe essential to this sort of debate, whether you truly believe that Heathrow will get a third and maybe even fourth runway.
No, it won't get them. I think it's politically toxic.
It won't.
It's politically toxic. I think it's a sensible thing to do, but I don't think politicians would be able to grapple with the political fallout if they were to go ahead and build a third runway. So it won't happen.
Well, how damaging do you believe that would be for Heathrow's place in Europe's overall?
Heathrow will decline. 10 years from now, Heathrow will probably have fallen out of the top five. 20 years from now, it won't be in the top 10 airports in the world, international airports in the world. So it's a huge mistake from a UK PLC point of view. From a BA point of view, we're all right in that we bought BMI, so that has given us slots to enable us to expand our network. But from a UK PLC point of view, it's going to have a negative effect on the UK economy.
Well, Willie Walsh, you haven't mentioned words. I suspect you've given me a news line once, which you're going to go see it.
I think we're in here.
I've seen a red light say we've run out of time. But Willie Walsh, thank you
very much
for joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, bear with us because we've got one more special guest this morning. He is renowned, I think, throughout the world of sort of business analysis as one of the great international sort of marketing and brand experts and consultants. He's written two best-selling books in this field. One was called The Brand Bubble, the other was called Spend Shift. And I think his overall message is that they're important and very interesting changes happening to the way people buy and sell and indeed live their lives, revolutionary changes. And he's just written another book which maybe more specifically gets to the heart of one particular way in which our cultural mindset is evolving and changing. He's called it the Athena Doctrine. The subtitle is How Women and Men Who Think Like Women Will Rule the World. It's a fascinating title. He's going to explain a bit more about it. So, ladies and gentlemen, please give a very warm welcome to John Gesner.